dry. There was so much water, I couldn't believe my eyes. And I was worried about my family. Will they be all right? Will they make it on the island for another night?
Many nations around the world have incorporated human rights provisions into their legal framework and now provide more basic rights to their people than the United States. In key instances, international human rights standards are broader and more protective than the U.S. Constitution or domestic civil rights laws. At this moment in history, the notion of applying a universal human rights framework to the United States seems to be striking a chord with activists around the country.
What do we want?
Human rights!
Where do we want it?
Now!
This is Ojamo Baraka, Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and you're listening to No Retreat, No Retreat, Compromise,
No Retreat, Compromise,
No Compromise.
As we transition from March to April, this episode focuses on topics related to internationally observed days in March, International Women's Day, and the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. We'll discuss two topics. First, a look at gender binaries and expanding the discussion of women's rights and human rights to include lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people. We'll also get details on the upcoming UN Durban Review Conference, the controversy surrounding it, and the U.S. threat to boycott the conference. Discussions of women's rights often rely on a conventional definition of gender. As Women's History Month draws to an end this week, Pauline Park joins us to discuss gender binaries and expanding the discussion of women's rights and human rights to include lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people. Pauline is a transgendered woman of Asian birth who has had extensive involvement with the LGBT community in New York and nationally. She is the co-founder of the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy, NYGRA, which is the first statewide transgender advocacy organization in New York.
Okay, thank you, Pauline, for joining us this afternoon. We want to talk about the complexities of gender and connect that to our concerns, of course, around human rights. So share with our listeners what you see as some of the elements of the conversation that may not be present when we talk about women and human rights.
I think there are two important aspects of this question. First is, why is it that transgendered women and men are largely excluded from discussion of women's rights? And second, related to it but distinct from it, is the question of why lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people are largely excluded from discussion of human rights more generally. And the two are related but quite distinct. So to start with the issue of the exclusion from conversations and discussions about women's rights, I think the fundamental problem is the sex-gender binary and the way in which Western feminists into and through the second wave of feminism in the late 60s and early 70s bought into a model, a discourse of biological essentialism, which essentially said that if you have a vagina, you're a woman, and if you have a penis, you're a man. And it was a very essentialist discourse that excluded, first of all, discussion of intersex, people who are born neither fully male nor female, and also excluded people who came to identify with a gender not associated with the sex assigned to them at birth. In other words, transgendered people. Now, that has begun to change in the last decade or so, and I think more up-to-date contemporary feminists have a much more transgender-inclusive vision, which, by the way, is also more firmly based on the need to challenge and dismantle the sex-gender binary. In other words, the division of the universe into two separate and distinct sexes and genders, which I believe is at the root of oppression of women in general, as well as transgendered people and lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people more generally. Now, with regard to the human rights framework, we also see an attempt, a deliberate and conscious attempt, to exclude lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered people from the conversation. There is a coalition unfortunately, of various member states within the UN, some of which are represent majority Muslim societies, with the Vatican to exclude sexual orientation and gender identity and expression from UN declarations and documents concerning human rights. That has been one of the biggest impediments to inclusion of LGBT people in discussions of human rights at the global international level. Fortunately, recently, at the meeting in Yogyakarta, principles were adopted, now called the Yogyakarta Principles, that state clearly that the United Nations and international organizations must address issues of discrimination based on sexual orientation as well as gender identity and gender expression.
In both in this country and in other parts of the world, there's this disability framework and how people approach the issue of transgenderality.
I think, unfortunately, while the transgender community is making progress in various countries around the world, often that progress comes at the expense of addressing the most fundamental issues at stake. So some transgender activists, and you see this, for example, in a number of Asian, Middle Eastern, and European countries, are using a disability rights framework to frame discussion of transgender issues. You see this, for example, in Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere, even in the United Kingdom, where transgender activists are pursuing legal rights under the rubric of disability because in the United States, as in other countries, gender identity disorder is recognized as a form of disability. The American Psychiatric Association publishes the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. We're currently in the fourth edition, and DSM-4 includes gender identity disorder, GID, as a disability. The problem is, it is a mental pathology. In other words, if you're transgendered, you are mentally ill simply by virtue of being transgendered. In my work, I have been arguing very strongly that we need to remove GID from the DSM. It's also important to recognize that most transgendered people do not want sex reassignment surgery, and most who do want SRS never get it, primarily because of cost, but also for other reasons. If that's the case, when you write into national law or subnational law, such as state and local law here in the United States, transgender rights under the rubric of disability rights, what that means is you can only seek legal redress for discrimination based on gender identity or expression based on a claim of having this quote-unquote disability, in other words, having gender identity disorder. Many transgendered people object very strongly to that because a lot of transgendered people, myself included, believe that GID is a false construct. As I like to say, I don't think I have a gender identity disorder. I think society has a gender identity disorder. The other problem with writing transgender rights into national and subnational law as disability rights is that when you do that, since most transgendered people never get sex reassignment surgery, you are in effect actually writing into law an exclusion that excludes most transgendered people from obtaining the legal rights or accessing the legal system as they ought to be able to. And so it's very important that we not be our own worst enemies as transgender activists, that we move beyond a disability framework to a much broader human rights framework, which says that you are entitled to legal redress from discrimination based on gender identity or gender expression, broadly speaking, and that you don't need to press a claim based on a false notion of disability, in other words, of mental pathology, as is written into the DSM with this diagnosis of gender identity disorder.
Is that an element that can explain what appears to be the lack of involvement on the part of many of the traditional human rights organizations to really begin to take a more serious look at the human rights issues related to transgender people?
I think that pursuing transgender rights under a disability rubric has two other consequences which really ultimately, I think, undermine transgender empowerment. First of all, we need to change. It is ultimately a battle for the hearts and minds when we're talking about LGBT rights and transgender rights in particular. We need to change the way people understand transgendered people, and I think we need to transform the way U.S. society and other societies understand gender, broadly speaking. When you pursue transgender rights using this disability framework, you narrowly constrain the conception of what transgender is, and you actually undermine the activists who are trying to educate the public on what transgender is, that in fact it is a perfectly natural variance in gender identity or expression. We need to move, in other words, from a deviance model to a variance model. In other words, being transgendered is simply a reflection of a natural variance in gender identity, just like being gay is no less or more normal than being heterosexual. Being lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgendered is not being deviant. It's simply an expression of a naturally occurring variance in sexual orientation and or gender identity. The other important respect in which pursuing transgender rights within a limited disability framework is profoundly problematic is that it really, in effect, cuts us off from other activists and movements, with the possible exception of the disability rights movement. We need to connect, in my view, as transgender activists, certainly to the women's movement, to communities of color, to the human rights movement, to broader movements for social justice and social change. It cannot simply be about getting limited rights for a tiny number of post-operative transsexuals who seek sex reassignment surgery and have obtained it. It has to be about connecting to other causes and other issues, which we certainly have within our community. Obviously, the transgender community is as diverse as any society in which you find that community. And it's important that we connect with these broader movements and articulate transgender rights as being about human rights more generally, and about a broader movement or set of movements for social justice and social change. It is in that context that I really find the model that we've developed here in New York, working on the state and local level, on bullying and bias harassment in schools, a really important and useful model. I'm involved as the representative of my organization, NIAGRA, the New York Association for Gender Rights Advocacy, in two coalitions, the Dignity for All Students Act, which is a safe schools bill pending in the New York State Legislature, and the Dignity in All Schools Act, which is a safe schools law that was enacted by the New York City Council in 2004, which unfortunately the administration of Michael Bloomberg refuses to implement. Both of these pieces of legislation have been advanced by broad coalitions that include organizations of color at the local level. That's been particularly the case with Asian American organizations, including the Coalition for Asian American Children and Families, ALDEF, the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, and the SEEK Coalition, as well as a number of LGBT organizations, women's organizations, etc., labor unions. And that model of organizing, in effect, is multi-community as well as multi-issue. And it brings together a broad array of different organizations and communities working together across these various artificial boundaries which often divide us. And so my vision for the transgender movement and community in this country is that we make these connections conceptually and practically as well, that we that we establish a foothold within the women's movement, within the human rights movement, that we conceptualize our struggle as linked to these broader struggles going on both here in the United States and around the world.
Pauline, that you have laid out much for our listeners to chew on, and that's exactly why we are so happy that you were able to spend some time with us this afternoon. And we are going to have to come back and spend an entire show on this issue.
March 21st is annually observed as the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. The Sharpeville Massacre occurred on this day in 1960 when police opened fire and killed 69 people at a peaceful demonstration against apartheid pass laws in Sharpeville, South Africa. The United Nations General Assembly proclaimed the day in 1966 and called on the international community to redouble its efforts to eliminate all forms of racial discrimination. This year, from April 20th to the 22nd, the international community will gather in Geneva to assess the progress toward the elimination of racial discrimination, xenophobia, and related intolerances. Ejim Dike, director of the Human Rights Project at the Urban Justice Center, speaks with Ajamu about the upcoming conference. Ejim has worked on social policy issues for over 10 years and in the domestic human rights arena for the past 7 years. Her work focuses on addressing poverty and discrimination using a human rights framework.
Ejim, thank you for being with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Ejim, we are hearing more conversation now around this Durban Review process that's going to be taking place in Geneva. For our listeners, can you briefly describe what we mean by the Durban Review process?
Okay. The Durban Review conference and process is basically a follow-up conference to the World Conference Against Racism that took place in Durban, South Africa, 2001. So that's often called the Durban Conference. And the Durban Review conference is to review the commitments that the global community made at that previous World Conference Against Racism.
And what were some of the responsibilities that governments took on once they came out of that first conference in 2001?
Yes, they produced what's called the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, which is basically a document that made a bunch of commitments.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important commitments is that it really looked holistically at the issue of racism. So look at how racism affects all spheres of our lives, economic, social, cultural, poverty. It made the link between immigration status and race. It looked at the specific issues that women of color face. It really is one of the most advanced and comprehensive documents on addressing racism that exists today.
Now, we are aware of the fact that at the first conference, the U.S. Ended up coming, but then they departed. They ended up boycotting the conference itself. But as you said, most of the nations that attended signed on to the Durban Program of Action that, among many things that you just described, also committed governments to develop a national action plan to address racism within their own borders. Now, one would think that that would be non-controversial. And so can you share with our listeners what is the current controversy taking place now that the nations have come back together again to review the progress on the Durban conference and the review process?
Well, the process there's an attempt to derail the process is the truth. The U.S. and Israel withdrew from the World Conference Against Racism in 2001, claiming that the process was singling out Israel for criticism. Now, if anybody actually reads the Durban Declaration and Program of Action, they'll be confused as to what the singling out is. The first statement that actually mentions Israel or refers to Israel recalls that the Holocaust must never be forgotten. So there's a lot of misrepresentation going on, and that has spilled into the Durban Review Conference. So the United States has stated that it will not be participating unless a few conditions have been met. One, that the new document for the Durban Review Conference not single out Israel, that they not have undue restrictions on freedom of expression under the guise of defamation of religion, and that it not include anything about payment of reparations for slavery. Now, those three conditions have been met, actually. Now, the fourth thing is now the U.S. government is now saying that they do not want the Durban Declaration and Program of Action reaffirmed in full. But they haven't stated what exactly they don't agree with in the Durban Declaration or Program of Action. So that's where we stand.
So if we didn't make sure we're clear, so there were these objections to the language, and the preparatory committee took the offending language out, if you will. But you're saying now that the U.S. has come back with an additional demand?
Well, it's there. It was a demand that they weren't very clear on. Now they're saying, and I spoke with them to the State Department today, that they do not want the Declaration and Program of Action reaffirmed in full. But like I said, they're not clarifying what it is about the first document that they find objectionable. And as I mentioned, if anyone reads the Declaration and Program of Action, they'll be hard put to find the objectionable paragraph.
Approximately how many states signed on to that document?
It would be all the states that participated in the conference, which is basically most of the states that belong to the United Nations, so over 170. However, there were two who withdrew, and that was Israel and the United States. So it's safe to say the global community has signed on to this document.
Okay. As a consequence of this controversy and the threatened non-participation on the part of the U.S., do you anticipate other nations not participating, and if so, which ones and for what reason?
Already, Canada and Israel have said that they will not participate, and they've stated the same reasons, singling out of Israel. The European Union had threatened not to participate, but they've now indicated that they're happy with the new document. We know that Australia is waiting in the wings to see what the United States will be doing. And there are probably a lot of other countries, particularly countries in the West, who are waiting to see what the United States will do.
We know about the Durban process. We know that it is concerned with addressing issues of race, racism, racial oppression, xenophobia. But we also know, and our listeners are aware of, another document that is a treaty, the International Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, that the U.S. has signed on to. What is the connection between this treaty, the ICERD, and the Durban process?
Well, the Durban process reaffirms CERD. Basically, there are three mechanisms within the human rights framework that address the elimination of racism. It would be CERD, which is the human rights treaty, the special rapporteurs, who are the special experts. There's a special expert on racism, and he goes and does fact-finding missions and investigations in countries. And then there's this conference process, and the one that has focused on racism is the World Conference Against Racism and now the Durban Review Conference. So there are three of the main mechanisms for addressing racism, and they support each other. And it's clear in both the Durban Program Declaration and Program of Action and in the outcome document that for the Durban Review Conference that they reaffirm CERD and call on all countries to ratify CERD and to remove current reservations that they have, which includes the United States.
Okay. So this is a clearly a very important part of the worldwide struggle against racism. And it appears at this point that the U.S. Has opted out of that process. We know that there are a number of people in this country that are concerned about the fact that, as part of the compromise, all references to the transatlantic slave trade was taken out, and any reference to the possibility of reparations were also excluded. So there's no indication there what else has to be taken out in order for the U.S. to participate.
They haven't been specific about it. And I think really what they need, I think this is more less a substantive process than it is a political process. The administration needs to hear from people that they care about this issue. They care about the United States with its history and its current situation with racial discrimination. They care that the United States participates in a global conference and discussion on eliminating racism, period. It doesn't matter the reasons.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we're not happy with the new document that doesn't mention anything about reparations. So not only do we want the United States to participate in a conference, we should be pushing that they include some of the language that has been removed as a compromise.
How can people get involved in expressing their opinion about the participation of the U.S. in the Durban process?
I think there are two ways. One is that they should start calling the White House and they should call the State Department. The number for the State Department is 202-647-5291. They should just flood the State Department with phone calls. We also have we had an open letter that we submitted to President Obama, but we now have it up in the form of a petition. And they can find that at our website, which is www.hrpujc.org. And I'm hoping we can also put it up on the U.S. Human Rights Network's website as well.
I think that we could definitely do that. So this has been very informative, Ejim. It becomes very perplexing why we still have this new administration taking the stance that it's taking. Well, we're going to thank you for sharing that information with us, and we're going to continue to provide updates on this process as we get closer to the actual dates of the meeting, which will be April 20th?
Yes, through 24th. Although we want to push the administration to make up its mind this week, because the next preparatory meeting or meeting in preparation for the conference takes place April 6th.
April 6th. Okay. We want to thank you again for sharing that information with our listeners, and we will be watching this situation very, very closely.
Well, thank you again for having me.
Underlying all human rights work in the United States is a commitment to challenge a belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movement have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. Network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, disability, women's, workers, immigrant, LGBTQ, prisoner impunity, and other rights movements that stand to benefit perhaps now more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. For more information on how to join the U.S. Human Rights Network, visit us online at www.ushrnetwork.org. Human Rights No Retreat, No Compromise podcast is a production of the U.S. Human Rights Network produced by Ajamu Baraka, Sunyata Altenor, and Jean-Bierre Williams, with Sugar Matthews, Tonya Williams, Drina Brown, Kalia Kunu, and Rachel Fowler. U.S. Human Rights Network at www.ushrnetwork.org.
In its wake, Katrina left a ravaged Gulf Coast and a nation shocked by the images of poverty and neglect that it revealed.
To the extent that the federal government didn't fully do its job right, I take responsibility. And it was